Good morning to you. Good morning. It's Sunday morning, February 2nd. It is. We're into February already. Hope you're having a good weekend. It's the BBG here, Sunday morning, with the newspaper review show as always. Looking forward to hearing from you on Twitter, at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Lots of interesting things in the newspapers today, besides Brexit and besides the so-called coronavirus. Lots to talk about, and I'm delighted to be here. It's a miserable morning in Salford, in Greater Manchester. Pretty horrible it is, but anyway, I've got you and you've got me.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yep, just opened Twitter right now, and I will be reading your tweets out as we go along, so do drop me a note this morning, even if it's only to say, how you doing? How you doing? Right back. All right, lots of tweets already then. Coronavirus scare and all of that. Hi to John, who's in the armchair with coffee and toast. How you doing, John? Nice to hear from you. How you, Liz? Hi to Ricky as well. And to Desmond. How you feeling post-Brexit, says Desmond? Pretty much the way I was feeling on Thursday. Because the UK hasn't left the European Union. And I don't believe it ever will. But I've said that quite a lot, haven't I? So I won't say it again. At least for 5 minutes. Anyhow, yeah. Lovely. Lovely stuff. Nice relaxing weekend. I'm still a bit under the weather, to be honest. And I've had a little bit of a relapse. Like that chest infection was gone. And then it's kind of come back. I've got a bit of a sore chest. It's a nasty one, isn't it? It sticks around this particular bug. I'm proud of myself because I've manned up. I've not taken any time off. And the only way I would do is if my voice went. And it does go once or twice a year. But anyway, I'm all right. I'll be okay before I'm married, as the old Irish saying goes. Good morning, Gail. Right, do send me a tweet. As I said, you know, it makes me think I'm not on my own, that I'm talking to somebody. Right, straight into it then. Let's look at the front pages. The Sunday Telegraph, Johnson fury as EU reneges on deal. Boris Johnson is apparently privately furious with what he believes to be a European Union attempt to frustrate a free trade deal. This is supposed to be done by December 31st, the day the BBG turns 46 this year, right? The Telegraph says Johnson, Boris Johnson, believes that Brussels has been changing the terms of an agreement that was made last year. The agreement last year, which aimed for a deep and comprehensive trade deal. I don't know what's going on because the Telegraph story makes this claim, but the text of the story contains no quotes, either from Boris Johnson or from sources at Number 10. I can't find them. I've read the stories word for word this morning, and it's all conjecture, it's all speculation. Sunday Express, Boris tells EU, no more concessions, screams the headline. The Express, which of course is a huge supporter of Boris Johnson and Brexit, claims that Johnson will set the tone for an assertive post-Brexit Britain when he gives a speech tomorrow. Some of the newspapers today have a photograph of Johnson banging a little gong, something which apparently happened at 11 o'clock last Friday evening. The Express says Johnson will say to Brussels, here are our terms for a trade deal. Take it or leave it, according to the Express. The Sunday Times, UK diplomats told to spurn old EU allies. There's an old-fashioned word, eh? Eh? Spurn. Lovely word. You don't read spurn too often in books these days, let alone in newspapers. It means to reject. To reject. It's another way of saying reject. British diplomats have been told to sit apart from their EU counterparts in new advice given by the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab. Sounds a bit childish, a bit churlish, a bit infantile. The paper says, the Times says, that diplomats have been ordered to make an immediate break with their former EU allies. When you're meeting with them at various meetings, global meetings and stuff, don't sit next to your EU counterparts, is the front page of the Times, which is a bit ridiculous, really. There's also a scare story on the front page of the Times as well. I won't read the text of it, but on the front page there is a story. The headline is, search for 480 from Wuhan lost in Britain. Yes, there are 480 potential virus-carrying people roaming around Blighty. With the virus, maybe. Or maybe not. Maybe they don't have the virus, but they might be carrying it. Before you know it, you know, you could have coronavirus. Mad stuff. We'll come back to that briefly in a minute. The Observer headline, Brexit day one, Johnson goes for broke with hardline trade deal. So as you can see, the paper's focused today on a speech that Boris Johnson will make tomorrow, in which it is believed that he will adopt a tough stance, saying, these are our red lines. Red line. No alignment whatsoever. And no access to our fishing waters. And all that sort of stuff. He's supposed to say this tomorrow. We'll wait and see. So that's the Observer. Let's hear a bit about this. Dominic Raab is the Foreign Secretary. And he was on Sophie Ridge on Sunday, whatever it's called, program on Sky News this morning. If this is true, says Sophie Ridge to Dominic Raab, this hardline stance, meaning no alignment, no regulatory alignment with the European Union whatsoever, it's going to mean checks, Foreign Secretary, and inspections of UK goods, Foreign Secretary, in Europe, and this will punish UK businesses. And you said, you and your Prime Minister, that there would be no checks. If you take a hardline stance, there are going to be checks. What did Raab say?
Well, no, because of the deal we've done with the EU. We've ended the risk of all of those worst-case scenarios, all those disruptions. We want to make sure that, and I'm sure they will, the Irish and the EU will live up to the commitments they've made, and we're committed to it. And, of course, Northern Ireland will leave the EU with the United Kingdom, will avail itself of not just the seamless trade with the UK, but with the rest of the EU, and we'll have the opportunity to be part of the global free trade agreements we're doing. And as I said at the outset, I'm going to be off next week to Asia, to Australia, to Japan, to Singapore and to Malaysia. And there are huge opportunities for all quarters of the United Kingdom with the liberal, energetic and ambitious approach to free trade we're going to do. And that's good for, remember, the businesses in this country.
I just want to come
consumers, it means more choice.
I just want to come back on the issue of checks.
Agenda.
I just want to come back on the issue of checks, because if the UK decides to diverge, if you don't want to align with the EU, there will be checks. I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong, whether it is a price worth paying or not, but it's just worth being upfront with people, isn't it?
No, it's directly in conflict, not just with the withdrawal agreement, but the undertakings in the political declaration. So, of course, we expect those assurances and those agreements to be kept to. That's why we've done this deal. It's a package. But the point I was making is I think we need to put the relationship that the UK has with the EU in the wider context of the agenda that we've got.
So when Michel Barnier says there will be checks...
That's really important.
He's wrong.
That's really important. But so are the global opportunities, particularly in the Asia-Pacific region. Massive growth opportunity for the United Kingdom.
Just to talk about checks, though. So when Michel Barnier says there will be checks, he's wrong, is he?
Yes.
Okay.
He's wrong if the EU lives up to its commitments on its side, both in the withdrawal agreement but also the political declaration.
Yeah, Dominic Raab there on possible checks after everything is said and done. What about the European Union response to all of this? Leo Varadkar is the Irish Taoiseach. That means he's the Irish Prime Minister. His party is Fine Gael or Fine Gael, depending on your pronunciation. He was on the Andrew Marr show on BBC One this morning, and he was asked about these claims that Boris Johnson is going to get tough, man. What did Leo Varadkar say? Leo?
I did. Well, first of all, I just want to say that we regret the fact that the UK has left the European Union, but we totally accept your decision.
We, as if he's got any say in anything.
And we're glad that it's happening with the withdrawal agreement in an orderly fashion. That means there'll be no hard border between North and South, and that citizens' rights are protected and the common travel area between Britain and Ireland remains in place. I think looking at your papers today, I would just really have one reflection. I think we all learned a lot. Certainly I've learned a lot from the past 2.5 years dealing with Brexit and dealing with two different British prime ministers. And one thing I'd say to everyone is let's not repeat some of the errors that were made in the past 2.5 years. Let's not set such rigid red lines that it makes it hard to come to an agreement. And let's tone down the kind of nationalistic rhetoric. You know, as is always the case when it comes to negotiations, setting out so boldly such firm red lines actually makes coming to an agreement more difficult, because the other party you're negotiating with doesn't feel they've got a fair deal unless those red lines get turned pink or bent in some way. And the second thing I'd say is let's be cautious about the rhetoric. We all want the UK and the European Union to have a close relationship, a political relationship, a security relationship, a trading relationship. It's essential for my country in terms of our economy and trade, our agri-food sector, our fisheries. So, you know, let's start off on a better footing than maybe was the case after the referendum.
Mm. Leo Varadkar is a spokesman for the European Union. He's not the Irish Taoiseach. Ireland doesn't have a Prime Minister. It doesn't have a Minister of Finance. It doesn't have a Minister for Justice. Ireland is an experiment in how far the European Union can go and how much it can get away with in completely taking over and controlling a, what once was a sovereign nation. That's not my opinion. It isn't. That's a fact. Ireland is nothing but a vassal state of the European Union. It's a disgrace what's happened to my country. And he's there, not as the Irish Prime Minister, the Irish Taoiseach. He's there, Varadkar, as a spokesman for Brussels. That's all. He makes no decisions. He had no say in anything. It's dreadful stuff. Any more?
Referendum. I think it just comes across as being a little bit petty. You know, it's kind of when you're in primary school or in...
Yeah, we won't listen to any more of that. The question that Marr asked him that I edited out by accident was, what do you make of UK diplomats being told to sit apart from their European Union counterparts, which was a story that's on the front page of the Times? Varadkar says it's just a little bit petty. I edited out the question in my haste this morning. Mea culpa. That's what he was asked. What do you think of this thing about people sitting apart? Varadkar says it's childish. Marr then brings up fishing with Varadkar. We're very interested in this. The Irish Taoiseach was asked about fishing. I think we'll hear Marr's question.
In the end, these negotiations come down to some fairly brutal horse trading. And one of the suggestions is that in return for full access to British fishing waters, the EU might give proper access to the financial markets based in the City of London. Now, Michael Gove has said a flat no to that. But is that the kind of horse trading that you expect to happen now?
Well, I think financial services are very different to fishing, and you wouldn't normally see fishing.
Andrew Marr is well aware of that. He's asking you about trade-offs, you numpty.
See financial services included in a free trade agreement. But I think we will need an agreement on fishing. You know, we do share seas, the Irish Sea, the Channel, the North Sea. The fish don't know where the boundary is.
The fish don't know where the boundary is.
So we'll need...
Maybe the fish need to know where the boundaries are. Let's go after the fish.
We need to have an agreement on access to fishing waters and fishing rights. And bear in mind, from the point of view of the United Kingdom, 70% of the fish that you land in the UK actually gets sold to European markets. So you're going to need access to our markets to be able to sell the fish that you land. If you don't have that, you'll have to find alternative markets and we'll probably end up getting a lower price for your product.
How do you know? How does he know that? That if fish caught in UK fishing waters, if it isn't sold into Europe, it's going to be sold at a reduced price elsewhere. How could he possibly know that, of course? But of course he doesn't. He's full of, well, bovine excrement, I would say. We're going to leave this whole thing now very briefly. We will, just before we do leave it, hear from Nigel Farage, the Brexit Party impresario. You might have seen Farage on stage at Westminster on Friday, old Nigel. Thought he was Freddie Mercury prancing up and down the stage with his jingoistic bullshit, old Nigel. He's as much of a sellout as Boris Johnson, of course, because he knows this isn't Brexit. Nigel is a lawyer. He was on with Andrew Marr too. We can hear some of that.
Nigel Farage, I suspect I know the answer to this question, but you were for a very long time highly sceptical about Boris Johnson's Euroscepticism. Was it real? When you read this, when you look at this, this is what you were hoping to hear, I presume.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was very sceptical when he did the so-called deal back at the end of October, yeah. But then, in the run-up to the general election, he made the promises, all the same promises that he's talking about today. Indeed, the Conservative Manifesto made it clear we would not have regulatory alignment. If we finish up with alignment, it means that the 88% of our economy that does not sell goods into the EU is still bound by EU rules, and that would not be Brexit. So look, I think he's saying all the right things.
He's saying all the right things.
I think he's being consistent.
Oh, he's not being consistent at all, actually.
With the manifesto upon which he was elected. And I think there's a big difference this time.
Boris Johnson is a Remainer to the bone.
You know, I don't think the EU ever took Mrs. May terribly seriously.
Who could?
I got the sense, I was there on Wednesday, my last day there. I got the sense in that debate that for the first time since the vote in 2016, they're a little bit more frightened of us than we are of them.
Really? And when it comes to this business I was going to say, why would we be angry with them? Is it when I suggested just now that we thought we had a free trade deal coming to us, and they're now saying, yes, but you have to hang under the European court and so on?
Yeah, I mean, what happened there was Donald Tusk, and he's on your programme later, Donald Tusk said to Theresa May, if it's a Canada-style trade deal that you want, we'll do it with you. And she rejected that. So kind of what's being said in the Telegraph is that Boris is angry that they've changed their minds. Yeah. But that was nearly a couple of years ago that was put on the table.
Yes.
What they fear more than anything, and bear in mind, Italy's in recession, Germany's very, very close to being in recession. What they fear is a competitor on their doorsteps. That terrifies them. And of course, what we should be doing in our national interest is to make sure that we are a competitor on their doorstep.
Any more?
Now, you will be observing all of this from the outsiders at the moment. Do you have red lines yourself which would lead you to say, actually, Boris Johnson is not doing a proper Brexit, and what are they?
Well, yes. I mean, before the general election, as nominations came up, I was asked, well, what are you going to do? Where are you going to stand candidates? And the reason I stood down 317 candidates and said to the Conservatives, you go for it, is because of those specific pledges that Boris made about regulatory alignment. So that, for me, is the absolute key. There are other things, too, that matter a lot. And I think fishing and how we deal with that is going to be on the table very, very quickly. We will see the Brussels document published tomorrow. So I think there are two areas that really matter.
And if he doesn't do what you want him to do, let me start off. Does the Brexit Party still exist?
Farage goes on to say, yes, the Brexit Party does still exist. It will exist as a sort of a watchdog to watch the government in its negotiation in the coming 11 months with the European Union. He also goes on to say, I'm saving time here, Farage, that a think tank has been set up. It'll be a Brexit think tank, right wing, obviously. Again, that will be watching the government to try and hold it to account. Nigel Farage. Let's quickly run through the rest of the front pages of the newspapers today. This is Sunday View with me, Richie Allen, the BBG, not the BBC. Lovely to be with you, as always. Thanks for your tweets. Just before we run down the newspapers, let me read a few of these tweets. Base Ninja tweets, wasn't that a threat, Richie? Sell the fish to European Union or... I'm so sick of hearing Farage, Mr. Anti-EU, but how much money has he made? How much has Mog made? Rees-Mogg, they're all criminals here and in Brussels that need attaching to trees by their ankles and left for the crow, says Base Ninja there. Dean says, Dean Smith, how you doing, Dean? I work in Grimsby, used to be a wealthy town. Adieu to fishing, best fishermen ever. See the place now since 1974, says Dean. It was thriving. Then post-74, it's been devastated. Even documentaries have mocked the place. Good people with their heritage taken away. Cheers for that. Dean there. David says, the fishing agreement should be here is the little line. Cross it and the Royal Navy has a nice few shiny shells for you. Bring a bucket, says David, taking a hard line stance there. Philip says, whenever the politicians say, now let's be clear, lies follow. Indeed, Philip, whenever they open their mouths even, lies follow. Hi to Susan at Ruby Dragon 1. I'm listening with my grandson. Hoping Richie doesn't swear too much. Well, Susan, I don't make any promises. I don't swear by design, you know. sometimes a little expletive will slip out. Can't make any promises there. Maybe it's not the best thing to do to listen to this programme with a small child, but that's up to you, of course. Hi to Paul Paranite. Hi to Daniel Ford. Richie, I'm listening to you Sunday View on the day that I celebrate 2 years of pay-per-view, my own podcast. Thanks for your support, says Daniel. Good man, Daniel. Well done. Podomatic.com if you want to look for, if you want to hear pay-per-view, that's paper, P-A-P-E-R, view, with Daniel Ford. Well done, mate. Good job. Delighted for you this morning. Hi to Steve as well. Let's move on. Excuse me, let's move on. The Daily, no. The Mail on Sunday. Now, I know a lot of my listeners are following Andrew, the Duke of York, and potential, I say it loosely, nothing is going to happen as far as I'm concerned, but potential legal trouble for him with a woman called Virginia Roberts Dufresne, who has accused him, of course, of having sex with her when she was 17. He denies it. Even though his interview with Emily Maitlis on BBC Two was laughable. There were so many lies in it, I don't know where to begin. The Mail on Sunday is reporting today on messages it has seen. The paper says, we have seen messages sent between Andrew and a friend of his, messages that were sent back in 2011. And in those messages in 2011, Andrew questioned the mental health of Virginia Dufresne. Again, the Mail on Sunday says, we have seen copies of messages where Andrew brands Virginia Dufresne as a sick girl. The headline on the Mail on Sunday front page is, Andrew's sick girl slur at accuser. He has declined to comment. The Mail have contacted the Palace. They've declined to comment. The Mail also reports claims by an actress that she was seduced by Rolling Stone's Mick Jagger when she was 15. This is Ray Dawn Chong. Now, I didn't look this up, and I'm often wrong. Wasn't Ray Dawn Chong in Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I could be wrong. I'm always wrong when it comes to films. She's told the Mail on Sunday that she was seduced by Jagger when she was 15, but that Mick didn't know her age at the time. Mick wasn't aware of it, she says. Mick Jagger has been contacted, and he has declined to comment as well. Sunday Mirror, front page, carbon footprints. Carbon footprints. This is about Prince Charles, who flew 125 miles by chopper to talk about lowering aircraft emissions. Yes, yes, of course. The paper, the Sunday Mirror, says old jug ears basically spent £12,000 on the flight and he incurred a carbon footprint of 2.5 tonnes. The Sunday People, Michael Barrymore, if you're listening outside the country, when I say the country, if you're listening outside the UK, if you're listening outside of Ireland, God's country, you might not know who Michael Barrymore is. He was a very famous entertainer at one time. He was, I suppose, one time what Ant and Dec are now. He was the darling of the British television watching public. And then he came out as gay. He had problems with drink and drugs. And then a man who attended a party at Michael Barrymore's house 19 years ago died. And this has been contentious for nearly 20 years now. Because Stuart Lubbock, who died at Michael Barrymore's party, his family believed that he was raped and murdered. He had horrific anal injuries. He was found floating in a swimming pool at Barrymore's residence. There is a new Channel 4 documentary. I believe it will air this coming week. And in it, Detective Chief Inspector Stephen Jennings will tell us that he believes that Stuart Lubbock was raped and was murdered. But he doesn't state any potential suspects there. I will watch that because I am interested in that this coming week. Star on Sunday, Big Bad Brother. Big Brother might be back. Oh dear, it might be back, Big Brother. And this time, in its new incarnation, Big Brother will feature fallen stars. Controversial people, once famous, whom had to retreat from the public eye because of controversial things they said or did. Oh, Lord Jesus. Lord Jesus, Mary and Joseph. Who needs it? Welcome to Sunday View with me, Richie Allen. By the way, the BBG, not the BBC. Great to be with you. 24 and a half minutes past 10. 11, even 11, Richie. It's 11. And this is AC/DC. You shook me all night long. Welcome to Sunday View. Back with plenty more in a couple of minutes. Isn't Brian Johnson one of the nicest guys you've ever met? Well, I never met him, but one of the nicest guys you could ever come across in your life. I don't know if you've got access to Sky Arts. It's a channel, obviously it's a Sky channel. But on Sky Arts, it's not new, he's done two seasons of it. But AC/DC's Brian Johnson has gone around the world spending time with some of the most famous musicians and singer-songwriters ever. And it's a beautiful series. Because he's a wonderful interviewer, Brian Johnson. The talents that people have that are hidden. You know it yourself, you've got talents that are hidden that people are not aware of. But Johnson is amazing. He's interviewed particularly the one with Dolly Parton. Now, I'm a bit partial because I'm a big Dolly Parton fan. I've got lots of Dolly Parton LPs at home. How can you listen, Richie, to hard rock and stadium rock? And how can you listen to folk music and Dolly Parton? Because I find beauty in pretty much every genre of music. And I love Dolly Parton. There's a lot you don't know about Dolly Parton and her background and her singing, her songwriting and how she wrote her songs. Anyway, Brian Johnson's interviews with many of these men and women are an absolute revelation. He's a star, you know, and he's not the star. You get what I'm saying? And that segues neatly, just before it segues neatly into my next topic. Before I do that, though, Jean Anne has been on. I don't know why I didn't think of this. Very good, Jean Anne. The new series of Big Brother with infamous celebrities. It would be great to see Prince Andrew on that, says Jean Anne. Book him immediately. Yeah, the problem is, you see, he'll never be in such financial difficulty that he will have to entertain doing something like Celebrity Big Brother. But very well spotted, Jean Anne. Now, speaking of interviewers, I'll briefly run through this. I don't want to pontificate because I've done it before, but Daniel Hannan writes for The Telegraph, and there's a very good piece in The Sunday Telegraph today. It is headlined, "Self-Important Broadcasters Haven't Yet Realised How Irrelevant They Now Are." And he asks, why do politicians give interviews? Seriously, why? 10 years ago, it would have been a ridiculous question. He writes, the media were precisely that. Media. Channels for whatever you wanted to tell your electorate. If you had something to say, it made sense to say it where it would reach the widest audience, which, unless you were targeting a very niche constituency, generally meant television. Okay. And he goes on to talk about how things have changed. He says Boris Johnson filmed and disseminated his own broadcasts in the recent election cycle. A video of him chatting as he made a cup of tea in a microwave was watched by millions. His Twitter and Facebook campaigns were brilliant. He knew how to use apparent gaffes or incongruities, comic sans font, for example, to get his messages repeated and discussed. Now, writes Daniel Hannan, while Johnson was doing all of that on his own and posting to social media, he turned down several set-piece interviews. He chose not to go head-to-head with Neil on the BBC. He stayed away from Channel 4 News' ridiculous climate emergency debate, a decision which was vindicated by Channel 4's juvenile decision to replace him with an ice sculpture. Hannan goes on to write, the legacy media fell about like affronted Victorian matrons. The electorate, they averred, would surely punish the Prime Minister for avoiding scrutiny. But, Hannan writes, the general population, as usual, proved wiser than the broadcasters. Voters were quite happy to make up their own minds about the various candidates without demanding presenters to frame things for them. There is nothing to be gained from appearing with interviewers who will grandstand, interrupt and show off. Nor is there much point in letting yourself be intermediated by someone who loads your party. Which is the reason almost all Tories have given up on Channel 4 News. Well, well, well. What has happened? I think he's making a good point here, Daniel Hannan, in the Sunday Telegraph today. I think he's right and he's wrong equally. What's happened to the media? What's happened to presenting, which is a job? Presenting a radio program is a job. Some would say it's a skill. Others would say, well, it's not a skill. It's stating the bleeding obvious. It's asking obvious questions. Now, when I went into radio current affairs, producing and presenting, there was no such thing as social media. There was no profile. You know, if you presented a programme, you didn't have a profile. You just fronted the show. That was your job. You know, you might present a music programme entirely different, but you might do politics and news. You fronted it. So you had a government politician on air and you asked him or her a few questions. You put the other side to him or her unless there was an opposition spokesperson right there. If they weren't there, you put their points of view to the government person. So if Fianna Fáil were in charge, you would say, well, the Fine Gael spokesman, Alan Shatter, he said this. What's your response, Minister? Simple as that, right? Your job was to steer it all. You researched the subject diligently yourself, because as a presenter, you don't want to be embarrassed. If the politician or the business person says something which is untrue, you don't want to be embarrassed. So you research the bejesus out of it. And if they need to be contradicted, you contradict them. That's all you do. You don't grandstand. You don't show off. You don't try to appear to be clever to your listeners. And you make sure that both sides get the same amount of time equally. It's got to be said, it was never a platform for you. Wasn't your show. You were never a celebrity. It's laughable. Celebrity. The idea that a current affairs programme presenter would be a celebrity is laughable. It's ridiculous. It flies in the face of common sense. You know? You couldn't offer your own opinion. It was a fantastic rule of thumb. And you didn't even need to be told it back in the day. You knew instinctively because of the people you worked around. I did my apprenticeship with world-class presenters. And I knew, I could name them, Carrie Crowley, Billy McCarthy, I could be here all day long, brilliant people, Maria McCann, still at WLR in Waterford, brilliant, never offer an opinion. Nobody cares about your opinion, shut your mouth. You're there on behalf of the listener who wants to find out things from these people. No celebrity, no profile. But these days, broadcast journalists have Twitter accounts, Instagram accounts. They're always on there opining about things, whether it's about celebrity things, whether it's about sport or whether it's about politics. Right? And the people I worked with, well, obviously this was pre-Twitter, pre-Facebook, they never saw themselves as celebrities anyway. And they never editorialised, which is basically expressing a point of view. And you knew instinctively, again instinctively, it was unwritten, it was unsaid, you left your own views at the studio door. Gay Byrne, one of the greatest broadcasters of all time, passed away late last year. Never appeared on other people's shows expressing his opinions. Never. Unheard of. He never went to marches or to vigils or got involved in causes or whatever. Nobody ever knew what he thought about things or who he voted for. Whereas today, every single presenter on mainstream media in the UK wears their political colours on their sleeves, which of course feeds identity politics. Because now what you have is you have men and women, ordinary men and women like you and me, now listening to radio programmes, only listening to radio programmes where the host is feeding back into the echo chamber that which we want to hear because it suits us because we're hearing our beliefs fed back to us. So if you're on the right now, you listen to, right, LBC, you might listen to Talk Radio, Julia Hartley Brewer, you might listen to Farage on LBC. If you're on the left, you might go somewhere else, you might listen to James O'Brien. That's what you get because these presenters are not journalists. They express a point of view, they are very firmly behind a political ideology. That's how it's gone now. And it's happened in the last 10 or 15 years. Programmes now have become all about the presenter. The shows are all about them. And guests end up being props. What do you mean by that? Well, the guest, no matter how well known the guest is, becomes a means for the presenter to showcase his or her own importance. Media is at rock bottom now. Rock bottom. Look at some of the people on Irish radio today. I was listening to Sean O'Rourke recently because he's a good friend of a very good friend of mine. And to be fair, it's really only on Irish national radio that it's done the way it used to be. You know, the presenter is almost anonymous. A link between the audience and the person being questioned. Very good. In the last 10 to 15 years, it's all about them. Me, 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 me. And the worst example of that on television in the world today is Piers Morgan on ITV's Good Morning Britain. About the worst presenter ever to bestride UK television. Utterly obnoxious. But yet it's working. It's changing people. It's changing the relationship that people have with the media. Because I reckon there's a whole generation of people that have come after me and they don't know any better. They think it's okay. You know, where do you get your news from? The Canary. Anybody else? No, the Canary. Why? Well, because I agree with that little dyke who writes for the Canary, Kerry-Ann Mendoza. Because I'm a Jeremy Corbyn supporter. But do you get your news from anywhere else? No. Why? Because she tells them what you want to hear. Piers Morgan tells people what they want to hear. Farage, LBC. And of course, that's a whole other area of research that I've talked about in the past. Now, not only do you have people like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump bypassing the media, which is shocking and dangerous, and broadcasting to millions on social media, it's worse than that. Now these fuckers are being given their own television shows. Who'd have believed it? Politicians getting radio shows. It's astonishing. How has it been allowed to happen? But that's the media in 2020. So Daniel Hannan is right and he's wrong in his brilliant article this morning. Presenters are wretched. The standards are so poor, they're so bad now. I never thought it could reach that level of ineptitude in media. But at the same time, the idea that it's okay for the politicians to completely bypass it and put out videos of putting cups of tea in microwaves and not be challenged. Well, it's shocking, of course. But again, there's a whole generation of people now who don't know any different. And I don't know. When I say terrifying, I really mean terrifying. It terrifies the absolute bejesus out of me. I'll be back in 60 seconds with plenty more. We're going away from politics, I think. Indeed we are. This is the BBG, not the BBC Sunday View.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Now, welcome back. Right, we're going to take a different direction now for the next 20 minutes or thereabouts. Quite a lot to get through, by the way. I'll probably go over midday, which pisses me right off. I'd like to time this for an hour, because then it repeats every hour then for the rest of the day. But I'm going to go over the time, I think. I could always edit out the music. I will see how it goes later on. Haven't mentioned the coronavirus, really. A couple of interesting bits just to get through. Back to Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab. There are Brits still in China, Dominic, said Sophie Ridge on Sky to him this morning. What the effing hell are you doing about it? Here's Dominic Raab's answer.
The challenge has been immense. You'll know that the Hubei province is nine times the size of Wales. We had a job to do to get the permissions for the charter flight going in, then the permissions to get the roadblocks eased for the UK nationals to get to the muster points. We had four coaches put on, and we delayed the original flight by 3 hours on the tarmac to try and make sure as many people could get out that wanted to get out. And obviously, as this flight with the French shows, we'll continue to work for those that didn't make the first flight to give them the cooperation, the support, and the reassurance that we can help them as best we can.
Now, but there's nothing really to worry about. And this is very interesting, isn't it? Who says there's nothing really to worry about? Well, a guy called Mark Fielder. He's a professor in microbiology at Kingston University, and he was on Sky as well, but with their presenter Gillian Joseph. Joseph first asks him about the vaccine.
Another worrying thing for people is the fact that there is no vaccine at this current moment in time.
No, there's no vaccine, but there's a lot of work around the world going on to make a vaccine. It's hoped that the vaccine will be available later this year, and that's largely been made possible by the fact the Chinese have made the sequence of the virus available very, very early. They've been very, very good with the information they've passed out, both epidemiological and health information, as well as information about the virus. So whilst we haven't got a vaccine, it does appear that treatment of the patient's symptoms seems very effective to keeping the patients alive. So I think there's a lot to be positive about.
We've got those 83 people in quarantine here and two confirmed cases here in Newcastle. What is the level of risk in this country?
I think it's low. I know we are officially at moderate level, and that's because the virus is here, but I think it's low. And the reason I think it's low is because all these patients are contained. We are watching, we are making sure we know where this virus is, where it's moving, where our patients are, and the practices that are in place to make sure that these patients are as safe as they can be and they are also isolated and can prevent onward spread are all in place, well rehearsed, well practiced and well understood.
Imagine that. Imagine that. There's a professor of microbiology saying it's not really a lot to worry about, really, you know. Because there isn't. This is going to disappear off the news in the next couple of weeks. And there'll be no follow-up. I've said this. 100 times. No need to keep saying it then. Very quickly, Sean Griffiths in the Sunday Times today. Sean Griffiths, interesting article. Headline, Trans Row Father is Willing to Go to Jail. This is Jabbar Hussain. He's 51. And he has been told by Birmingham City Council that he's in trouble for taking his son Amin out of Parkfield Primary School in Birmingham last year. They're coming after him for failing to ensure that his son attends school. Jabbar Hussain says, I took my son out of school because I will not allow him to learn that he may be in the wrong body. And he is the first parent, by the way, in the UK to face prosecution having withdrawn his child from school because of the LGBT lessons row. It's very interesting in the Sunday Times today. Okay, if he's found guilty of failing to ensure that his son attends school, he could be fined up to £1,000. And he could have a parenting order imposed on him. Imagine. If he doesn't pay the fine, he could end up in jail. Could lose his child. Staggering, isn't it? We'll take your child from you. Why? Because if we tell you you can be born in the wrong body, that means you can be born in the wrong body, Mr. Hussain. Again, who is responsible for the raising of your child? You? Or the state? Well, the state, obviously. Again, I'm not going to dwell too much on that. We've gotten into it too many times. This is the new sex and relationships curriculum. It will be compulsory in every school in England from this coming September. Parents will be allowed to withdraw primary age children from lessons focusing on sex if they want, but the relationship content itself will be compulsory. The schools, Parkfield School in Birmingham, uses a syllabus of about 30 picture books based on a programme called No Outsiders. Some of the books include Tango Makes Three, about two male penguins who adopt a chick. Talks about gay and transgender relationships, same-sex families. The programme also uses Introducing Teddy. Now, Teddy is about Thomas the teddy bear. And Thomas questions his gender identity. Thomas tells his best friend, I know in my heart of hearts I'm a girl, Teddy, not a boy, Teddy. Yeah. Some parents don't want their children exposed to such ludicrous, monumental bollocks. But they're facing fines. Isn't it interesting, eh? We're going to follow this, of course, very closely. And on the theme of madness, here's a story on RT.com, which appeared yesterday, written by Graham Dockery, who's an Irish journalist who works for RT. The headline is Transgender Cop versus Disabled Teenager, a courtroom drama for our time. It actually reads like some television drama. It's mad, really. Transgender cop versus disabled teenager. But it's a real court case. What's going on? Graham Dockery writes with a bit of humour. A transgender police officer and a teenager with Asperger's syndrome walks into a courtroom. It's not a joke. And it ends with the disabled teen under house arrest for a hate crime. Welcome to Intersectional Britain, writes Graham Dockery.
What kind of fuckery is this?
What's fuckery, Amy? Police community support officer, so not even a real police man or woman or police it. Connor Friel was born a woman, but now identifies as a man. Connor Friel, who was born a woman but identifies as a man, is also a transgender activist. And Friel was on foot patrol in the northern Welsh town of Mold last October when he was heckled by 19-year-old Declan Armstrong, who shouted, "Is it a boy or is it a girl?" at him. Insulting? Asks Graham Dockery. Yes. Insensitive? Yes. A hate crime? Well, yes, according to Mold Magistrates Court this week. The court heard how the cop, Connor Friel, born a woman, identifies as a man, was left vulnerable, distressed and embarrassed by the incident. And the Asperger's teen, Armstrong, was found guilty of violating the Welsh Public Order Act 1986 by using abusive or insulting words with intent to cause harassment. The teenager was ordered to pay £590, including £200 in compensation to PCSO Friel, and was slapped with a curfew order for 12 weeks. Welcome to dystopia. Jesus wept. Yeah. Orwell is in his coffin like this. Marvellous. Bravo. 12-week curfew order and a fine of £590 because you asked, is it a boy or is it a girl? And the PCSO was left very vulnerable. I was vulnerable. I need the state to protect me. I couldn't just walk away and ignore the little bastard. No. No, we had to report a hate crime. Hate crimes. Oh, fuck. I'm just leaving that one there. The BAFTAs are on today. Tonight. The glitterati. Hollywood's best. And the UK's best actors and actresses, or most famous ones anyway, will be on the red carpet, this after a diversity row. Who gets nominated? Well, Joker has 11 nominations, The Irishman and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood have 10 each. But the World War I epic 1917 is expected to win the top prize of best film. Sam Mendes made that. It's almost like a single shot, apparently. Over a couple of hours, I have no idea. But it's a big row about diversity. All 20 acting nominees are white, and no female directors were nominated for the 7th year in a row. Because women are shit at directing films, probably. I don't know. What do I know about it? This meant there was no room for a black British star, Cynthia Erivo, who went on to be nominated for an Oscar for her role in Harriet, which is a biopic about slave-turned-abolitionist Harriet Tubman. I've watched a bit of it, to be honest. It's a bit shite. At least I thought it was, right? I get access, you see, to screeners and things because I'm still in the club, or at least I still get privileges going back to my mainstream media days. I still get to see things from time to time. She wasn't nominated, and everybody is pissed right off. Sky News got into this morning. Amy Nicol is an author and broadcaster. She's not happy. And she's with the presenter Gillian Joseph again asking the questions here. You'll hear Gillian Joseph first, then Amy Nicol.
It's not the first time we've heard this diversity issue being raised. But in this instance, it does need to be called out, doesn't it?
I think so. And I think it's tempting to think, oh, were they just moaning about nothing? But then when you look at the evidence, the films are there. And this year, it's more about the films and the actors that haven't been nominated, more than the ones that have been nominated. If we look at the example of the British actress, Cynthia Enviro, for Harriet. The film's just been completely snubbed, whereas an actress, like an Australian actress, Margot Robbie, she's been nominated twice in one category. Also, Hustlers, Jennifer Lopez's film. Well, not Jennifer, you know, Jennifer Lopez is in the film. Completely just not even given a look in. It just seems bizarre that the films are there, and they're not being acknowledged whatsoever. Yeah. Also,
well, what would you say to those that say that the films are chosen on merit and not in terms of the diversity or the female directors?
That's what I'm saying.
Well, there you are. That's the question, isn't it? That is the ultimate question. Maybe the people getting the responsibility, or maybe the people with the responsibility to determine which films get nominated, chose the ones they did based on the fact that they liked them more, maybe, and that they didn't care about the colours of the production team and the actors and actresses, just maybe.
Saying, because the films that have been left off these lists are fantastic, wonderful.
But maybe the films on the list are fantastic too.
Wonderful films. And when you look at the nominees for Best Film, say, it's not representative of when you look around the street and we look at where we live.
It's not representative of when you look around the street and of where you live. What's that got to do with anything?
Your standard five male white directors. And like I said, the amazing talent is there. The films are incredible. Like, but I do feel like when I look at the things that have been missed off, like Jordan Peele's Us, which has Lupita Nyong'o in it, and Hustlers, I don't know whether it's more of a class thing, because the younger, cooler films, I hate to say it, the fresh...
The younger, cooler films.
...is the stuff that's kind of been left out. And that's possibly why BAFTAs has a bit of a reputation, perhaps, for being slightly pretentious.
She referenced younger, cooler films, but the BAFTAs have a reputation for being pretentious.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Pretentious.
Because look at The Irishman, it's 3 hours long. I mean, I haven't seen all of it.
Fuck it, how can a film get a nomination if it's 3 hours long? What?
I haven't been able to take annual leave yet. But it's just like, if you've seen Us...
Ah, piss off, love. Right, enough of that. I want to finish today with Robert F. Kennedy, who was on RT America this weekend. Robert, of course, from the legendary, the famous, the... behemoth American family, of course. He heads up Children's Health Defence these days. He was on RT talking about vaccines. I've got a 3-minute cut for you to hear where Kennedy brilliantly discusses the revolving door between the CDC, of course, the Centre for Disease Control in the United States, and Big Pharma. Everybody in the world should hear this. CDC, of course, is supposed to regulate Big Pharma and scrutinise them and punish them when they do wrong. But Kennedy brilliantly outlines here, better than anybody I've ever heard do it, just how in cahoots, there's a word, the CDC is with Big Pharma. Everybody in the world should hear this. Robert F. Kennedy breaking it down. Do not miss a word of it.
Well, there are many, you know, there are revolving door problems with all of our federal agencies and all of our state agencies. There's a phenomena that is very well documented called agency capture, which is a phenomenon or a dynamic by which the agency that that's supposed to protect the American public from bad drugs or from pollution or what have you ultimately becomes a subsidiary or a sock puppet for the industry that it's supposed to regulate. And indeed, that's what we see with the CDC. The head of CDC from 2002 to 2009, as you point out, was Julie Gerberding. She did a number of billion-dollar favors for Merck. She silenced a whistleblower who was William Thompson, who is still a scientist at the CDC, who wanted to tell the public that testing of Merck's vaccine showed that particularly the MMR vaccine was causing autism in black boys and other people who got the vaccine on time, and that the scientists had been ordered to destroy data showing that effect, and that they went ahead and published the study, lying about it to the American people and to physicians. And Julie Gerberding did a huge favor to Merck by having that scientist punished and then silenced. She arranged for Merck to get the monopoly to the multi-billion-dollar MMR vaccine and to make sure Glaxo could not sell its vaccine in this country. She approved the HPV vaccine, Gardasil, which is another Merck product. She approved the chickenpox vaccine and the silenced whistleblower, Gary Goldman.
This is all true. This woman, working for the CDC, approving vaccine after vaccine after vaccine, no safety tests whatsoever, silencing whistleblowers. Listen now, this is truth.
Goldman, that is another doctor who said this vaccine is going to cause a shingles epidemic. Merck then not only got the chickenpox vaccine, but it also was able to market a shingles vaccine. She retired in 2009 and she was made president of Merck's.
She retired in 2009 and was immediately made president of Merck, eh?
Division in 2010 with a salary of about $2.5 million. I think about
$2.5 million a year. The woman should be in prison for the rest of her life, right? This is why you should never take a vaccine. I'm not saying that vaccines don't work. I can't say that. I'm not saying that vaccines might not work or could not be useful. I'm not saying that. They don't test these things. Whistleblowers are silenced. The CDC people responsible for protecting people in the United States go on to work for these people. He's fucking laying it out there.
$5 million in stock options. CDC is actually a vaccine company. CDC has a total budget of about $11 billion a year. It spends $5 billion of that buying vaccines from those four companies and making sweetheart deals that are much higher, where we pay with taxpayer money much more for the vaccines than they pay for the exact same vaccine in Europe. And then they...
He goes on to talk about the costing of vaccines, how people get ripped off. What he just said there, every American should hear it, and every American should be scratching their heads wondering why the woman is not in jail. Running the CDC, making decisions to benefit Big Pharma, silencing whistleblowers, firing people, and then retiring and going to work for Merck on a salary of over $2.5 million a year. Holy Mother of Divine Jesus Christ. That's why I would never take a vaccine. Not me, not anybody connected to me. Thanks for listening to Sunday View. Look after yourselves and one another. Have a brilliant rest of your Sunday. I'm leaving you with the boss. And I'll talk to you tomorrow at 9:30 UK time for the nonsense that is the Paper Review. Bye now.